Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. I'm your host, Sam Notla. Last time, we talked about voter suppression of felons. We took a look at the broad scope of felon voting laws. We responded to some pro-suppression arguments, hopefully well enough to defeat them, and we looked at some real-world impacts. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the Ban the Box movement, which was based on removing the checkbox that asks if applicants have a criminal record from hiring applications. So basically, it's just saying any kind of employment applications can't ask if you've had a criminal record, or they delay that question until way later in the hiring process, at least. For today, we're going to talk about something similar, but with regards to housing. Similar to how people can be rejected from jobs solely due to their criminal record, even though jobs don't typically have any legal ability to do this due to protections on federal level, they can also be refused apartments and housing. However, there are almost no legal protections against refusing housing based on criminal records. There are some exceptions to this. NOLO.com, for instance, states that under federal law, landlords aren't allowed to discriminate against tenants with felony convictions for drug use, for example. But on the other hand, they're allowed to discriminate against felons who produce drugs, things like that, and everything else, of course. But the trend in general is clear. With that introduction to the concept, let's get started. So the first thing that I want to make clear is the kind of impact that these discriminatory laws, or lack thereof, actually, have. The story that's most recently available and has gained some signal is the story of Willett Benford. So in June of 2019, on the website curb.com, Jake Biddle wrote a story about her struggle in finding housing in Chicago after being released. As a result of having been released, she had trouble finding a steady job. If you remember what we just talked about with Ban the Box and the Ban the Box episode, that would directly relate to her employment situation, and she was staying at a homeless shelter. And so the question to begin with is, you know, what was her crime? Apparently she'd been convicted 2 decades ago of murder after running over her girlfriend, who had been domestically abusing her for months. When Illinois' domestic violence laws were updated, allowing domestic violence to be a mitigating factor in sentencing, she was immediately released from prison, according to Olivia Stovacek on Injustice Watch. But what she found after that was that a large portion of landlords and an even larger portion of what they call affordable housing landlords had blanket ban policies that refused anyone with a criminal record from receiving housing from them. These policies do exactly what they sound like. Everyone with a criminal background is refused, regardless of the rest of their application, how long ago they were convicted, any mitigating factors since then. And it's a difficult thing to deal with, especially if you're someone like Benford. So Benford had served time for 20 years. 20 years later, she was being treated as if she had committed the same crime the day before. And so what happens then is that you start a vicious cycle, which is something Benford talks about. Simply put, the way the cycle works, if the ex-incarcerated are refused housing, which is a basic necessity, then their life will be inherently unstable. In such an environment, it's no surprise that many would be pushed to recede into crime, regardless of their own personal inclination. However, this story itself does have somewhat of a happy ending. After she and other formerly incarcerated people testified in front of the Cook County Board of Commissioners, a fair housing ordinance was passed, which applies to Cook County. The push for fair housing ordinances has come off the back of the success of Ban the Box movements, and these ones aim to prohibit landlords from denying applicants with prior convictions. So the one that passed in Cook County, I believe, made it illegal for landlords to discriminate at all based on the criminal backgrounds of tenants. I could be wrong, there might be a few caveats with it, as there were others, but as far as I saw, that's what it is. So these movements, the Fair Housing Ordinance movements, they cite several key pieces of information towards their end. For example, recently released individuals are far more likely to experience homelessness due to their difficulty in finding an affordable apartment. According to Lucius Culotte of prisonpolicy.org, formerly incarcerated people in general are almost 10 times more likely to be homeless than the general public. And it's important to note that that 10 times more likely number is actually for all formerly incarcerated people. So this includes people who are released just yesterday at the same as people who were released like 10, 15 years ago. And obviously it'd be easier for people who were released a long time ago to find housing since they were released. So then what we should really look at as well is the rates of homelessness amongst people who were just recently released. And so what they found is that among all the formerly incarcerated, people who were released in the last 2 years are more than twice as likely to be homeless as those who were released 4 or more years ago. And so this is on top of just the general incarcerated, the formerly incarcerated population being 10 times more likely to be homeless, and then you have twice as much if you're recently released on top of that. And so then the plight of the recently released then becomes even more pertinent. Though to be clear, it's not only them that we should be fighting for. We should be fighting for housing for everyone, including everyone that was previously incarcerated. And so when you have stats like 80% of the ex-incarcerated reporting being denied or being ineligible for housing based on their record, according to the Ella Baker Center, it's clear that this is a major problem to begin with. The report continues by saying that even then, you have about 58% of the ex-incarcerated that end up living with family members. But on top of that, which is even more appalling, the study found that 1 in 10 family members were actually evicted when their ex-incarcerated loved ones returned. And this is because a lot of landlords, which is how you get like this 1 in 10 eviction number, they can just evict you based on like really flimsy reasoning. And so some landlords evict based on this principle, that if you have someone with a criminal record living with you, you are liable for their criminal record, so they're allowed to evict you based on that. So then it's crazy because not only is it difficult for the ex-incarcerated to find housing, but their very presence can put their loved ones at risk of eviction due to discrimination from landlords. So you have a really difficult decision that they have to make then, right? Which is, do I decide to just be homeless, or do I stay with my loved ones but then strain our relationship by putting them at risk of eviction? And this, as always, this kind of issue always has a racial component to it as well. For example, ex-incarcerated black men have a 50% higher rate of homelessness following release compared to Hispanic and white men. Another report shows Hispanic men also fitting to the same rate of homelessness as black men, however, with both having about double the homelessness rate of white men. So there are a few different reports, but the common thread that emerges is that if you are black or Hispanic, you have a much higher rate of homelessness post-incarceration than a white man would. And while the prison policy report didn't have large enough pool of black or Hispanic women to report the exact numbers on, they still found that the rate of unsheltered homelessness was substantially higher than it was for their white counterparts. And the plight of black women here is even more dire, as previous studies show them with homelessness at twice the rate of black men and four times the rate of white men. And the thing is, these issues might even be worse than is currently reported. So the prison policy report itself addresses a key point that was unobserved in these statistics and in a bunch of previous reports, which is that a significant portion of the ex-incarcerated are in housing, but they're in marginal housing, meaning that they lived in a rooming house, hotel, or a motel, which are also inherently unstable, ways of being sheltered. And so for every homeless ex-incarcerated individual, there were almost three times as many in marginal housing. I think the actual numbers were something like there were about 203 in 10,000 who are homeless, either sheltered or unsheltered, and there were about 570 in marginal housing, 570 in 10,000 in marginal housing. So what that would mean is that current reports that include marginal housing, which are the vast majority of reports on homelessness of the ex-incarcerated, they're ignoring a huge population of the ex-incarcerated, which would paint the issue yet again as even worse than it already is. And as I mentioned earlier, the cycle of crime and homelessness continues due to laws like this. The whole idea of the fact that if you don't have stable housing, you're more likely to be led back into a life of crime, which then perpetuates. Well, this whole thing to begin with, which is that you get incarcerated, you go out, you can't find housing, then you go back to jail. People have actually, there have been a lot of studies and, or not studies, sorry. There have been more stories, is what I mean. And these stories are about the fact that a lot of people that don't have housing after they get incarcerated decide to commit a crime solely to get back into prison. Like, there were stories in the news about a man who robbed a bank and then turned himself into the police because he needed a place to stay, a place to live. And while prison was terrible, it was still somewhere that housed him. And so you see these kind of significant issues, and then you question, you know, well, where have we made some progress, right? What are people doing? And what you get is you have some progress being made in other areas, but with significant pushback. So the initial story was about Cook County, but that's not the only place that fair chance housing ordinances have been passed or are being fought for. So according to Biddle in the Curbed article that we referenced at the beginning, you have, quote, deep-seated stigmas against people with criminal records, making it difficult to push for fair chance housing policies. In particularly liberal cities like Washington, D.C., New Orleans, and Seattle, fair chance housing ordinances were able to pass by 2016. The movement gained a lot more traction in 2016, though, when Obama's Department of Housing and Urban Development issued a policy memo stating that it was illegal to deny housing based on a criminal conviction, citing the 1968 Fair Housing Act. It's important to note, however, that this memo is not a law, but rather just an interpretation of that act, and what that means is that it could still be challenged in court based on that interpretation. However, regardless of that, it still did have a significant impact in galvanizing and giving activists the crucial support that they needed to get local fair chance housing laws passed in the first place. So for example, at the time of the article, San Francisco, Detroit, Newark, New Jersey, and Kansas City had also passed such laws, and Portland and Berkeley were pushing to pass them. In Richmond, California, there's a project called the Safe Return Project, and they work to pass similar laws. The Safe Return Project is kind of just about getting the ex-incarcerated incorporated back into their communities, but housing is a big portion of that, which is why they are pushing for things like this as well. But I just wanted to know that this isn't the only thing that they're fighting for. And so their founder, Tamisha Walker, said that common arguments on the other side were things like, oh, it's a challenge for everyone, referring to housing scarcity, in California. But when she interviewed people with a steady income and everything else that they needed for a successful application, she found that they were consistently stopped from getting housing due to their previous convictions. They faced extra significant pushback due to the recent rent control laws at the time, which had landlords being extra defensive, meaning that they testified en masse against the fair housing laws in groups during hearings, or you had these big lobbying groups that would testify on their behalf. And this was a common thread in other campaigns as well, just to be clear, like those in Cook County and Seattle. It's not like these fair chance housing ordinances passed without there being a lot of pushback. It's surprising that they got through in spite of all that, and it's a testament to how much work the activists did on that regard. And so in Richmond, what happened was it led to a much weaker fair chance ordinance being passed due to all this pushback. And so what happens is that the ordinance prohibits discrimination against the ex-incarcerated, but only the ones who receive affordable housing subsidies. So if you're ineligible for those, or if you just haven't gotten through with an application for one of those yet, these laws wouldn't apply to you, and so you'd still be discriminated against by landlords. But it is still progress on the behalf of thousands, so on one hand, we should still be happy for what we get, even though it's a reminder that the fight for that isn't over yet. But, you know, even after these ordinances passed, there's still the difficulty of implementing and enforcing them, which took Richmond over a year to figure out. And there are many lawsuits against such ordinances even now, which are spearheaded by conservative legal groups. In Seattle, there's the Pacific Legal Foundation, which has kind of been funding and fighting for this. Or I guess rather against these laws. In blue states like Seattle, right, the battle to get these ordinances passed is difficult enough with all this pushback and everything. Like, again, remember, we're talking about states like California and Seattle. In red states, you actually have activists finding even more pushback, to the point where in Madison, Wisconsin, they had one of the first fair chance ordinances on the books and in the nation, but the state's overwhelmingly Republican legislature overturned it completely a few years back, and they went even further after that by preventing any local anti-discrimination legislation that went beyond Wisconsin's civil rights laws. So even just passing the ordinance in many areas, that's not the end of the fight. Even if you pass it that said, no, you can't discriminate against people's criminal backgrounds at all for housing, because they can still be overturned by your state legislature and everything. This move was then similarly copied by Texas's Senate, which used it to block a Ban the Box movement in Austin. This was for employment, but it's the same kind of sentiment, and that's the sentiment that this movement gained traction off the back of in the first place. And so many times you can see that a movement will gain traction only to lose that ground due to a powerful lobbying or influence group, like those of landlords and legislatures. Progress on a federal level, which would supersede state legislatures, has been present, but it's been extremely slow. Local initiatives have been much more successful, on the other hand, but they face the issues stated earlier, which is the fact that they can be overturned so easily or challenged so easily. So, on a federal level, the Fair Transit Housing Act of 2019 was introduced in July of last year. I believe this was by Senator Kamala Harris and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. It included various provisions, including the banning of blanket one-strike policies, which are policies that landlords can use to say, if you have anything on your criminal background, we'll disallow you from housing. It also banned no-fault policies. Those policies allow eviction of an entire family based on the criminal activity of a guest. It also raised the standard of evidence used by public housing authorities when screening or evicting based on criminal activity, and it prohibited the use of suspicionless drug and alcohol testing, amongst many more things. One of the issues with this is that these stipulations all fall short of getting rid of discrimination on the level of many of these local ordinances, like the one in Seattle. But as a federal act, their scope would be much larger. So the compromise is that their effectiveness is hampered, but they apply everywhere. So if something like this passes, it's a huge deal because it basically puts a floor down for how low you can go, which is still much better than where it is at a lot of these places right now. And so this bill has a support from a variety of activist sources, such as the National Low Income Housing Coalition, Shriver National Center on Poverty Law, the Human Rights Watch, the NAACP, and many more. I think there's a list of, I think, probably like around 30 or 40 co-sponsors on that bill. There was like a similar Fair Chance Act that was pushed by Elijah Cummings in February of 2019, I believe. But what happened was that it had parts of it incorporated into the recent budget that also increased the military budget. So like you had parts of that being passed, but I believe that this one would be much more comprehensive and have a lot more stipulations that one didn't have, as well as not being tied to some other budget full of horrible things. So just as a side note, I should also note that there is Section 8 housing, which is public housing that's available to some felons, according to healthforfelons.org. However, many have noted that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is known to have a very slow response time due to the number of related requests that it receives. There's just such a big need for housing amongst those who have been incarcerated. And furthermore, those who qualify have to pass various qualifications. For example, those eligible need to have a low income and or a low value of total assets. So the issue there, right, is that if you need to have a low income, then what happens if you get out of jail and you find a job that's really great and everything, you have a good income, but you still don't have housing? Well, you haven't gotten your first paycheck or anything, and you still don't have housing, so you're still in a terrible spot. Furthermore, you need to be screened for criminal activity and alcohol or drug abuse, which again, if you're someone who's in a vulnerable position, this is something that would hurt you. But from their rationale, I suppose it makes sense if they want public housing to be safe and everything. Even then, there are many crimes which would outright disqualify felons of ever receiving public housing in the first place. So, like, even if you committed a crime like 30 years ago and then you're released today, depending on your crime, you could still be, you could just be disqualified of ever receiving public housing. And even then, if you pass all of these qualifications, there still isn't a guarantee that you'd receive public housing. It just means that they're at least willing to consider you. There's also the option of transitional housing, which gives many felons the chance to ease themselves back into society, and is rent-free and funded by subsidies. Proponents of transitional housing say that it gives felons structure and accountability. It gives them small chores and makes them subject to room searches. But many note that this is still much more freedom than given when incarcerated, and is meant more to prevent them from falling back into their old habits rather than to rigidly control their lives, while detractors, on the other hand, say that it's pretty much just putting them back in the same environment that they had when they were incarcerated. My opinion is probably a bit more on the pro-transitional housing side, where it's still better than the alternative, while not really subjecting them to nearly the same level of, I guess, oppression or control as a incarceration system would. And I do buy the argument that the structure and accountability is a good thing, at least for when they just get out and find that they need that. Especially when we talk about things like recidivism and the high rates of recidivism that we see in our ex-incarcerated population. And so what you have there, the issue there is painted as a big issue in housing for the ex-incarcerated. But as usual, it also highlights a fundamental issue with how we view rehabilitation and our prison system. If we don't consider a person rehabilitated enough to live amongst us after prison, then what is prison for in the first place? Like, does it just rehabilitate people a little bit, but to a degree where we should still shun them and everything, right? That seems a bit crazy. Why should a conviction be a permanent black mark on people's records? And furthermore, if you excise the ex-incarcerated from our communities by refusing them housing, then you haven't rehabilitated them, but you've continued to, what you're doing isn't rehabilitating them, but you're punishing them after their time has already been served. This also perpetuates segregation based on an already deeply flawed justice system. And the segregation not only cuts off people from their communities, but from their loved ones as well, who, as we mentioned earlier, are at risk of evictions if they house an ex-incarcerated individual. You know, time and time again, we talk about how amongst the ex-incarcerated, you have this big feeling of alienation from society in general. And things like these housing restrictions just go further in alienating the ex-incarcerated. It tells them further that not only are they different mentally and everything, but now here we're going to physically divide you from living near the people that you lived with before by forcing you to find housing in somewhere like transitional housing or public housing. I feel like it is a very real way of segregating these communities and further alienating them, and it's something that we should all be concerned for with regard to that. And so activists fighting against such sentiments have a difficult road ahead of them, but they are at least making some progress nonetheless. A lot of these are local groups that end up pushing these laws. It's not typically some big national group that pushes these into place, which makes this much more of a local fight. There are some people on the federal level, as we talked about, Elijah Cunningham back in February, Ocasio-Cortez and Kamala Harris more recently, but for the most part, it's a local issue. I find that this also has tie-ins to how we view society from a more materialistic bent. So, for example, allowing housing is made strictly into a cost-benefit decision. What I mean by that is that landlords see the ex-incarcerated as posing a higher risk, you know, whether that's not paying their rent, causing problems on their property, or whatever, even if it's not a substantially higher risk. And that's what the decision is made based off of this cost-benefit analysis instead of a decision based on people's basic needs. So when housing laws don't protect the rights of felons because landlords are afraid of their income being affected, it tells us where our priority is as a society are. When public housing requests take so long to get to, when it's so limited in availability, when they have numerous qualifications just to get in the door, it tells us where our priorities are. And I think that it's about time that those priorities change. And it seems that a lot of activist groups are doing great work on this behalf, but it's important to note that this is a really recent phenomenon. Like, remember that back when we talked about the cities earlier, it was just like three major cities by 2016, and these were considered to be very liberal cities in the first place. You have a lot of cities where these laws get passed and they just get repealed by the state, and then the state also uses that opportunity to repeal a lot of protections from other places. For example, like the one we talked about in Wisconsin, where they used repealing of that ordinance as an opportunity to say, okay, well, now you can't have any local anti-discriminatory laws that go past our Civil Rights Act. And that further divides people in these movements because you could have people in the fair housing movement being blamed by people in other civil rights movements because it was their law being repealed or their ordinance being repealed that led to all these other civil rights protections being repealed. But with that having been said, I think I'm going to have that as our show for today. I'd like to encourage everyone to check out the articles and reports that I reference because they go much more in depth than I have. They have a variety of figures and actual statistics. And it's also important to note that a lot of these reports are replications of previous ones as well. So you might want to look at it in terms of a historical perspective, see how homelessness, housing issues with the ex-incarcerated have changed over time. And there's also many questions to think about on this topic for the future. So just for a few examples of what those questions might be like, you can ask yourself, where should our priorities lie as a society, as I talked about with the cost benefit versus, just providing housing thing. Should housing instead be a human right guaranteed by our government? Or should we just regulate private renting to a greater degree? Where should we draw the line between material benefit and our responsibility to our fellow humans? And that's to say that even if you take the landlord stance, I think that most people would agree that there should be some limits to the amount of discrimination that you can do in housing. And I mean, most people do agree, right? We have lots of anti-discrimination laws on the books. But even if you're just looking at it from a cost-benefit analysis, we should still ask, at what point can we say, okay, well, that's going too far in that direction? But with that having been said, with all those questions being asked, although I know there are many more to consider, that'll be our show for today. Thank you for listening, as always. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, feel free to email us at prisonjusticeshow@gmail.com. Until next time.